The news was read by Jane Steele. Now, it's not often you hear a medical doctor owning up to making dodgy diagnoses, but that's about to happen, as Phil Hammond bears all to Stephen Mangan in Radio 4's confessional booth. He's also sparked a few Twitter storms in his time, as we'll hear in just a moment. Meanwhile, tomorrow night's 6:30 comedy is best enjoyed with a pint at hand.
On BBC Radio 4.
Right, the challenge
has been set. Paul Sinha and his live audience compile the questions for the perfect pub quiz.
For the PR teams of the River Nile and River Amazon have fought long and hard for the title of the world's longest river.
Comedy and bar trivia.
Turns out it's the Nile on account of being longer. Somehow that's just how facts work.
Paul Sinha's perfect pub quiz.
You're very much blurring the barrier between fact and fiction here.
On Radio 4 and BBC Sounds, starting tomorrow night at 6:30.
Back to tonight, and now Stephen Mangan continues his research into guilt, shame and blush-making embarrassment. This week he delves into a world where mistakes are often a good deal more than merely embarrassing. Expect medical stories as he ushers his latest guest into the confessional box to reveal three guilty secrets.
I'm Stephen Mangan. Welcome to The Confessional, the show that brings out the worst in its guests. In this series of private confessions, we fling mud at them with impunity by getting them to dig the dirt on themselves. It's ethical journalism. So whose confession are we taking this week? Time to reveal them in all their brazen glory. My guest today is a doctor who does comedy, because that's really where we need doctors right now. He's a patron of both the Herpes Viruses Association and Kissing It Better, which, said in that order, sounds a bit optimistic. A very warm welcome to Dr. Phil Hammond.
It's a slight table's turn, this. I'm used to nerdling confessions out of other people. That's the beauty of medicine, is complete strangers come into you and tell you their most intimate secrets, supposedly in confidence, and then you turn them into a comedy show, obviously anonymising them first.
So you're an expert. I mean, you must have people who come in and are reluctant to share exactly what's wrong with them. Either they're embarrassed, or how do you get the information out of people? Are you one of those people who just sits there in silence until the silence becomes oppressive and they have to speak?
In medicine, for me, it's all about relationships with patients. That's what you get a kick out of. So I think if you create the context that's kind and supportive, I'm here to help you as best I can, and I'll tell you honestly when I don't know something, then people share stuff. Mm-hmm. But there's a danger you go fishing for a hidden agenda. We were taught, oh, you know, somebody comes in with back pain, they're always depressed, or they've got sexual difficulties, and you just need to find the hidden agenda. And sometimes it isn't there. You turn over a stone and there's nothing underneath it. And you think, oh, right, I was hoping for some juicy bit of tattle there, and actually they do just have a bad back.
There are degrees of honesty, aren't there, and straightforwardness. I mean,
yeah, I remember Mark Thomas did a great show when he was coming up with a People's Manifesto, and he asked the audience for suggestions to improve things. And one of the suggestions was, for one day of the year only, doctors and patients should tell each other the truth. And that really made me laugh, because yes, it is a bit of role play, and there's a lot of acting in medicine. I guess the reason a lot of doctors become comedians and actors is because the two are quite similar. Most people, when they become successful comedians, give up the day job. I've always enjoyed medicine, and I jokingly say I've always needed the material. You're never short of comedy material if you hang around in the NHS.
I've always been fascinated by undertakers. I mean, it's slightly different along the sort of the chain of command from where you are, but, you know, you come in to work as an undertaker and you're feeling really chipper, or you've just asked someone to marry you and they've said yes and you're feeling great about the world. You have a game face you have to put on, don't you, I suppose?
We want meaning and purpose in our lives. And you know, if you're an undertaker, you're a frontline health and care worker, you work in the NHS, you're a teacher, you're an actor, you're a comedian, you're doing a job of worth that moves people and changes or improves their life, or you're doing a bullshit job where you don't really have to put much of a face on because it doesn't really matter either way. So I think that the jobs that are most worth doing are actually really tough at times, and often you make mistakes and get them wrong.
Yeah.
But you know that you're trying your best and you know that they're worth doing.
Well, making mistakes and getting it wrong is entirely what we're here for today. We don't want to hear about you doing a worthwhile job in a worthwhile way. We want to...
Yes, is anyone from the General Medical Council listening in? I just want to...
Are you comfortable with the thought of, pardon the expression, exposing yourself?
Well, yes, because I've done it. I mean, that's what I learned. That's what Struck Off and Die, which is the first double act I was in with Tony Gardner back in 1990 as junior doctors, we confessed our mistakes on stage. And it was very frightening at the time. It was, in, you know, junior doctors working 120 hours a week and we were all exhausted. And there was a political movement to stop it. And we decided actually comedy was the best way of saying, look, we're not gods, we're humans, we're young. You're making us work 120 hours a week. We're patrolling the wards unsupervised, killing patients when we're tired, and then burning the notes and burying the x-rays and covering up. It taught me the confessional power of comedy to get a serious message across, I guess, which is what Struck Off and I was. It was comedy with a message.
This was supposed to be the moment when I solemnly escorted you down a dark and echoey corridor and into our own specially commissioned confessional box, but we can't do that, obviously, because of health and safety. So we can conjure up an imaginary confessional box of our dreams. So, Phil, what kind of box would you feel most comfortable to confess your sins in? Would it be a plush Harley Street surgery, or Chesterfield and impressive bookshelves, or a funding-starved NHS basement, all stale tobacco and black market chlorophyll?
I'd actually like one with a view. I know that's not traditional, because in a confession you're generally facing the person you're confessioning to, but if I could have like a shepherd's hut up on a hill with a view of Chew Valley Lake,
okay,
that would be my ideal place to confess.
So you could look, gaze out onto the horizon and revisit your mistakes in your mind.
And the beauty of nature. We know that connecting with nature is good for your health, so even if the confessions went really badly and I get struck off as a result of this,
right,
I'll still have that view to cling on to. It won't all have been negative.
Okay, well, Dr. Phil Hammond, can I please hear your first guilty secret?
I went into medicine for a number of reasons. One of the reasons I went in is that I had a shocking ginger basin haircut and National Health spectacles that looked like a sea slug had fallen asleep on my eyebrows. And my older brother, Stephen, favourite child, was this bronzed Adonis who had all the girlfriends, and I couldn't, for love or money, get a girlfriend. And I figured that the placebo of a white coat and a medical degree might help. And I was very good at science. And my stepdad, Stan, was a builder. And he was lovely. He was a West Country builder. And he used to go, just do what you're good at and do what you enjoy and try to be a decent man. He was absolutely lovely, Stan. And he knew I wanted to be a doctor. And he saw me cutting a loaf of bread one day. And I was shocking. I'm not great at hand-eye coordination and had a big step in it. And he said, Fowler, I know you want to be a doctor, but promise me you won't be a surgeon. And so I went into medical school knowing that I wasn't very good with my hands. And at medical school, I was known as Dr. Fumblefingers in the best possible way. And I generally avoided helping out in theatre because I knew I wasn't very good at it. But when you qualify, you have to do some practical stuff. You can't get away from it. And my first job was as a house surgeon, which meant I would have to be in theatre and do stuff. And my consultant was Mr. May, and he was a lovely old surgeon. And I remember my first day, we were on take, and this bloke pitches up in the emergency department with a sebaceous cyst on the top of his head. And Mr. May thought it would be a good idea to let Dr. Fumblefingers have a go at removing it, having never done one before. And I said to Mr. May, are you going to come with me? He said, no, here's a book, Procedures in Practice. See one, do one, teach one. That was the mantra. So he just gave me this book, page 16, Removing Sebaceous Cyst. And I opened the book and it says that these cysts never turn into cancer or do anything nasty, but they can regrow if you don't get them out. So you need to remove them with a wide elliptical excision, is what the book said. So I put some lignocaine in and I removed the cyst on the top of his head with a very wide elliptical excision, and I put it in a pot. And then I looked at his head and I realized I'd carved a huge great hole in the top of this bloke's head. And I thought, well, what am I going to do about that? I can't call the plastic surgeons out on my first day as a house officer. They're going to think I'm an imbecile. So I got the suture material, and with all my might, I tried to suture these two widely spaced skin edges together. I mean, I really put a lot of effort into it. And at one stage, his ears lifted up about 3 inches on either side. It was like an instant facelift. And I finally managed to get the skin edges together, and I felt very proud of myself. And I whipped my gloves off with a flourish, and I realised I'd sutured a glove to the top of his head.
No.
It looked like something out of Last of the Mohicans, or like a giant human cockerel, or somebody going to a fancy dress party. But in those days, you weren't allowed to admit you made a mistake. You know, in those days, you covered everything up. So I said to this bloke, look, no need to worry about that. This is part of a new dressing we're using at Franchet Hospital. We're experimenting with a new dressing. And this bloke walked out of the emergency department, pleased as punch. His ears were 3 inches higher on either side, and he had a glove stuck to his head. And I swear, he said, thank you, doctor, for all you've done. That was 1987, when people trusted doctors and they didn't sue us. Isn't that extraordinary?
Wow.
And thank you, doctor, for all you've done.
Is he still wearing a rubber glove on his head, as far as we know?
I don't know. And if you're listening, I'm apologising now. I didn't. I mean, that was, it was like a double whammy. I'd made a mistake, but then you didn't admit your mistakes in those days. You covered them up.
So he's got a hand stuck out the top of his head.
He may still have it. Doctor didn't say when the dressing had to come off, so I'm just leaving it there. I don't know.
I wonder if he keeps accidentally buying things at auctions.
It was the fact that he was so grateful. So that's one of the ways I think medical culture has changed. And in fact, it changed a lot while I was there because we moved. Mr. May discovered something called a laparoscope. And so in the old days, for just about every operation, we used to hack a great big hole in the abdomen to try and remove the gallbladder or the spleen or whatever. And then somebody invented this telescopic surgery with a laparoscope with the guarantee that with a tiny incision, you could remove organs without the big scar. And it was a huge surgical revolution. But, you know, some surgeons picked it up on this sort of see one, do one, teach one basis and caused a lot of damage, cutting the ureter or cutting the bile duct, whatever. But some, like Mr. May, went off and used it properly. I mean, they learned how to use it properly. And he would call us in at times we weren't expecting to demonstrate his new laparoscope. And I remember one night, I wasn't on call the next day, so I'd gone out for a curry and a few beers with my mates, and I'd had a fairly rich old curry and only a couple of pints of Guinness, nothing too bad. But I woke up in the morning and Mr. May summoned the whole team into theatre for an emergency appendicectomy. He was going to try and remove somebody's appendix with a laparoscope for the first time ever. Mm-hmm. And he called me in and I wasn't expecting it. And I hated being in theatre because I was always cutting the sutures too short or too long or holding onto the wrong piece of equipment. But on this occasion, it went really well. The whole team is there and I'm holding onto this bit of equipment and he's doing a marvellous job removing this bloke's appendix. And then out from me slipped the most unpleasant, silent but deadly fart.
Oh.
You know, one of those farts when you've combined Guinness and a curry.
Okay.
And you're sort of holding on and you're not sure whether it slipped out or not. And this appalling smell
right.
filled the operating theatre. Absolutely terrible. And I thought, gosh, this is really embarrassing. But it got worse. The nurse said, I smell faeces. The registrar said, I smell faeces too. Mr. May said, damn, I must have perforated the bowel. I'll have to open him up.
No, no.
Yes, yes.
At which point you said, it was I. I'm so sorry.
No, I didn't. It was an ethical dilemma that could have gone either way. Now, I could have put my hand up and said, excuse me, sir, but
yeah.
I made that heinous smell in your operating theatre. Can I have my reference now, please?
You didn't let them open him up.
Or I could have let them open him up like a zip while they searched for the non-existent hole in his bowel. But I came up with a third way, very, very cleverly and very silently. I leant forward to Mr. May and I said, I think it was sister.
You blamed the nurse.
That was it. I blamed the nurse.
And the nurse under the fart bus.
That's terrible, isn't it? And to this, I would like to apologise now to sister in French Operating Theatre in 1987 for the reputational damage I caused her at the time. And generally, can I say, nurses saved my life as a junior doctor. They realised I was Dr.
It's too late now, Phil, to go grovelling back to the nurses.
I know, but I just want to make that point. Is that nurses play an essential role in the training of junior doctors that isn't recognised.
Yeah, sure, whatever, too late. Actions speak louder than words, forget it. So there seems to be a difference here then between doing the right thing as a doctor and just not getting caught. With the hand on the top of the head and the passing the buck,
yeah,
it's all about, you know, keeping a clean sheet, if you'll pardon the expression.
It was, and I think that was the culture of medicine at the time. I think... make amends for that. But when I trained, it was a big dark secret that we didn't have enough junior doctors. The reason they worked 120 hours a week is that we didn't get paid much for overtime. So it was cheaper to make one doctor work 120 hours than three doctors work 40 hours a week. We sort of got away with it, but I would say I matured as a doctor. And after I started blowing the whistle on junior doctors' terms and conditions on stage at the Edinburgh Fringe, it was recorded by Radio 4, and we got a record number of complaints to the Broadcasting Standards Council because they broadcasted after the Archers, and it was a very bleak black show. And I remember Lady Howe, chair of the Broadcasting Standards Council, upheld the complaints as inappropriate material for a comedy show. And on the back of that, Radio 4 offered us a series and an invite to the Radio 4 Light Entertainment Christmas Party, which you may have been to. And I descended the stairs in between Frank Muir and the Beverly Sisters, I remember. And I spotted Ian Hislop, the recent editor of Private Eye, and I'd always wanted to write for Private Eye, and I followed him into the toilet. And I said, Ian, can I have a column in Private Eye? And he said, do you mind not standing so close to me? But he'd had a plan to recruit more specialist writers for the Eye and recruited me to write under the pseudonym MD, because he said I would face professional ruin if I wrote under my own name. And I started writing mainly about junior doctors killing patients when they were tired. And then, because I was in Bristol and Tony, my comedy partner, was in Bristol, we stumbled across the fact that far too many babies were dying after heart surgery at the Bristol Royal Infirmary. And the junior doctors at the time had nicknamed the unit the Killing Fields and the Departure Lounge, in that really dark medical humour. And Tony and I told that story on stage at the Edinburgh Fringe, which sounds very inappropriate now because it turned into the largest public inquiry in British history. And it taught me a pretty harsh lesson that you think you're funny on stage and, you know, oh, I'm doing comedy, I'm addressing really big issues, there's nothing you can't do jokes about, it's just how you do the jokes. I know all that stuff, but when it becomes what was at the time the largest public inquiry in British history, it's suddenly not so funny. You know, why were you making jokes about that when we now know that dozens of babies have died and been brain damaged? So it taught me a bit of a lesson, but it also changed medicine irreparably. That and Shipman meant that people decided doctors shouldn't just be left alone after they qualified to carry on. They needed a regular form of appraisal and revalidation.
Let's hear your second confession.
What we currently have to do is an annual appraisal every year, and after 5 years, we're then revalidated. Our license is revalidated by the General Medical Council. And the really important bit of the annual appraisal, probably the only useful bit, is every few years we have to do a 360-degree appraisal, which means you ask everyone you work with, your secretary, your consultants, the junior doctors, the cleaning lady, but most importantly, patients and relatives, what they think of you.
Right. Doesn't that depend on how well they're healed?
Well, there's a bit of that. There's a bit of that. If you do it properly, you're supposed to do 25 consecutive ones. You can game the system. So if you have a really bad consultation that's gone terribly, you can just forget to record that one.
Right.
So there are opportunities for gaming, but I try and do it properly because I pride myself on my communication skills, and I'm incredibly lucky. I work in a specialist clinic for young people with ME, chronic fatigue syndrome, and other causes of severe fatigue. And our rather visionary consultant has noted that these kids are so appallingly treated and have really been around the houses that if we have an initial long consultation of up to 90 minutes, that will have tremendous therapeutic benefit. So if you can't, as a doctor, improve somebody's situation in 90 minutes, you're in the wrong job. What I do when I do my appraisals is that I say to the receptionist, look, here are 25 forms and I want you to give them to 25 consecutive patients and not miss anyone out. I want to do this by the book, because I'm confident I can get good scores. Anyway, I'm doing this well. I don't know why I did this, but I always meet my patients, and they always come. The young people always bring a parent, sometimes two, along to the consultation, and I go out and greet them in the waiting room and say hello and check them out and then invite them into my consulting room. And I, to the life of me, don't know why I did this. As someone who has lectured in communication skills at a couple of medical schools, I know all the rules. And the first thing you do is you don't assume. Well, these days, you don't assume the gender of the young person. Sometimes you're told in advance and sometimes you aren't. But also, you can't assume the gender of the person that they've brought with them. So the safe thing to say is, who have you brought with you? So, hello, Miranda, thank you for coming. Who have you brought with you? And for some reason, I didn't do this. I walked out into the waiting room during my appraisal period and I glanced at the young person and said hello. And I glanced at the person with them. And for whatever reason, I said, and you must be Dad. Halfway through, you must be Dad, when I realised it was Mum.
Oh.
There's a real misconception of chronic fatigue syndrome that it's yuppie flu, that it's prim middle-class people who haven't quite achieved what they want in life. And it's a horrible slur because chronic fatigue syndrome, ME, is a real condition, often post-viral. We're seeing a lot of post-COVID fatigue now. But it's more common in working populations. And this mum had clearly had a hell of a time looking after quite a few children, all with medical conditions. She looked absolutely knackered and drawn. And for whatever reason, I thought she looked a bit like a bloke. And I said, and you must be Dad. And I'd realised, and I thought, if I switch to you must be Dam-ma, that will sound even worse.
Right.
So I had to sort of follow through. And I said, and you must be Dad. And the daughter with chronic fatigue syndrome, who previously looked really miserable and apparently hadn't laughed for a couple of years, absolutely roared with laughter. I mean, she howled. with laughter to the extent that other people were looking at me in the waiting room.
And mum/dad?
And mum/dad was just looking at me, I mean, quite severely, I have to say. And I just didn't really know what to do. And there was a really difficult pause. And the mum looked at me and she said, it was just very strange. She said, Doctor, you should have gone to Specsavers. And she was lovely. I mean, she got me out of it. She got me out of it. I wasn't sure how it was going to go. And actually, as I walked them into the waiting area, the receptionist, bless, who was handing out the appraisal forms for afterwards, she said, do you want me to put that one aside? Shall we not count this one? And I said, no, I want this one to be counted. And I did pull out all the stops. I did the best ever consultation I think I've ever done. And when my appraisal forms came back, I mean, they're anonymous, so I don't quite know, but I had 25 highly satisfied and one fairly satisfied. And I'm thinking the fairly satisfied patient feedback and carer feedback may have come from that particular mum.
Yes, well, I can imagine.
But she was lovely about it. The daughter kept laughing right the way through the consultation. She giggled and laughed about it. And generally, I try to make people laugh in my consultations constructively, but I've never made somebody laugh like that. And the mum accepted that I'd made an honest error and I apologised for it. And she gave me permission to tell this story.
Oh, did she?
She said, I know you're a comedian. And I said, yeah, would you mind? Obviously, I've anonymised it, but would you mind if I told this story without ever identifying you? She said, no, that's fine. I actually think it's quite funny. And we laugh about it as a family.
Excellent. So that's two confessions. We've had an accidental facelift and a rather unfortunate sewing up and a misgendering. What are we going to get for your third?
The third confession is quite a contemporary one and extraordinarily embarrassing one. It's a good lesson about the dangers of Twitter. And I don't know why I did this, but back in January last, 2020, I was feeling quite optimistic about this new flu that had come out of Wuhan. For a number of reasons. When it was identified as a SARS virus, I knew that we'd managed to stop SARS in 2003 mm-hmm. with excellent global health cooperation. And I knew since 2003 we had even better technology, better tracking systems. So I thought there's a fair chance if it behaves as it did in 2003, I know it's a sort of like a cousin virus, not the same virus, we would be able to stop it. And then a few days after announcing the outbreak, China disclosed the entire genome. So we had the entire genetic sequence really quickly of this new coronavirus. So we could immediately work on vaccines and work on a test for it. And then 3 days after that, the Germans produced a test. And a few days after that, the British had a test. So I thought, with all these tests and our brilliant, renowned public health expertise, we'll be able to stop this. And what happened in 2003 is we did stop it and more people globally and in the UK died falling down the stairs than from SARS. That was true in 2003. And I thought the same would happen again. So I confidently tweeted on January the 24th that I thought it'd be the same again as 2003 and more people will die falling down the stairs than from SARS. Now, in the hindsight, a year or so later, this looks like the most embarrassing tweet of all time. But I haven't deleted it. And the reason I don't delete it is that both medicine and comedy rely on error. And to progress, you have to accept your errors. So I leave my mistakes up there. And I've been absolutely ridiculed and ripped to pieces for it. But I keep saying this was an honest mistake. Here it is. Let's all learn from it. Because I'm rather wary that lots of people want to be grand inquisitors in this pandemic and they want to line the government or all the advisors up against the wall and shoot them and say, you've killed 150,000 people. And it's a lot more complicated than that.
Yeah.
So when I look back on my tweet, I think, yeah, okay, I got that wrong. Mm-hmm. But I then spent a year writing for Private Eye trying to understand why I got it wrong. So I've been writing 2,000 words a fortnight for Private Eye, and it's the best writing I've ever done. And one of the reasons it's good is that the Private Eye readers correct me. The beauty of the Eye is it's the closest we have in this country to a free press. So Ian Hislop gives me no pressure or direction. I'm absolutely free without editorial interference or political or advertorial commercial interference to write exactly what I want. And then you stand or die by your errors that are nearly always picked up by the readers.
Well, let's just for the record, I do have the tweet in front of me. I'll read it out. I mean, it'd be a shame to come all this way and not hear the actual tweet. You wrote, "More people died falling down the stairs than from SARS. The media never ignites a killer stairs scare, but it loves a killer virus. Currently, 2019 nCoV has moderate transmissibility and relatively low pathogenicity." I'm sure I'm not pronouncing that right. "I predict, again, more people will die falling down the stairs."
Yeah.
I mean, good on you for leaving it up there.
I'd cut and pasted, to be fair, I'd cut and pasted a bit of Richard Horton's tweet. So Richard Horton is the editor of The Lancet, and he'd talked about it being moderate pathogenicity and transmissibility. And I cut and pasted because I thought, well, he'll be right. He knows what he's talking about.
Right. They're the two errors there, aren't they, really?
There are, but he and Private Eye both got it wrong over MMR. You know,
right.
They both, Private Eye and Richard Horton and The Lancet, both followed the hypothesis that MMR might cause autism.
Yeah.
But
that's the beauty of science, isn't it, really? Science says, you know, this is our best thinking, and it's humble enough to go, well, that's now, we now no longer think that. We think this instead because of the evidence.
Yes, it is that, and it's how you communicate that. So risk, there are four things about risk. It has to be assessed, it has to be managed, it has to be communicated, or it can be ignored. You know, we all deal with complex risks every day. Climbing up and down the stairs is one, people do. About 800 people die falling down the stairs every year, so it's not a negligible risk. And more deaths probably happened during lockdown because people were pissed or wearing masks or whatever. But we manage those risks every day sensibly without living in fear. And I think my hope at the beginning of the pandemic is that we would communicate sensibly and say, okay, there's things we don't know, but let's do these sensible things. And then let's get on with enjoying our lives within these restrictions. You know, our one wild and precious life is not to be lived in fear.
Hmm.
But then the government lost control of the virus and had to use a tactic of fear and heightened anxiety to control us all. And so then when there's a very mild or rare vaccine risk, they have terrible trouble communicating it. You know, your chance of dying from this vaccine and every vaccine is about 1 in 1,000,000. You're far more likely to die, here we go, falling down the stairs, traveling in a domestic accident, taking paracetamol or taking aspirin and overdoing the dose. So risk communication is what we do. And I think that's probably where comedy will come in and save us eventually, that people will, you know. I was asked at the very beginning of this, my last gig before lockdown, and somebody said, can we still have sex with coronavirus? And I said, yes, but only in the wheelbarrow position. You can do it outdoors. It's good for your lung function. Very little risk of viral transmission. And if you do go past your mum's house, you know, shop in for some groceries and check she's okay. And I think there's a really important role for comedy. And they did it in Taiwan. Taiwan managed this pandemic better, A, because they didn't trust the Chinese, B, they locked down quickly and did border control, but C, they used humour. They had a humour, not rumour plan to prevent pandemic spread, and they did it without promoting fear.
So thank you for those confessions. It sounds to me like you're no stranger to public confession anyway. I mean, with the tweet, it's been out there for a while. Has this helped today at all to get these things off your chest?
I'm a big fan of the power of conversation. I think it's really, we're losing the power of conversation. We're so obsessed with screens. You know, what's kept me going through this? I have a group of mates called the Wednesday Elders, and we normally go to the pub on a Wednesday. And we thought, do we really want to do Zoom meetings? But we've maintained a Zoom meeting once a week throughout the pandemic where we've confessed stuff and absolutely roared with laughter and said stuff that if it was broadcast, you know, on the news or in the Daily Mail would get me struck off, because you do with your mates laugh at stuff that's completely inappropriate. So, yeah, the power of confession and conversation, I think, is really important. And it needs to come with understanding and kindness. Don't judge people just because they screwed up, but learn from it.
Absolutely. That's exactly the ethos of this show. So thank you. Thanks very much, Phil, for letting us hear your confessions.
Thank you.